This week, our local orca pod, the J Pod, thought it had something to celebrate. A new orca was born on Tuesday. And for these endangered southern resident whales, every birth is critical. But within a half hour, this new calf had died. And its mother has spent the last 2 days with her baby on her back and the rest of the pod slowly swimming behind her through the San Juan Islands in the Haro Strait. To human eyes, it sure looks like a funeral procession and another reminder of how fragile the Northwest orca population is right now. Let's learn why this matters with Dr. Jason Colby, Associate Professor of Environmental History at the University of Victoria. He's also the author of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. Dr. Colby, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me on.
Have you seen those photos of this orca carrying her dead calf?
I have indeed. Really, really heartbreaking. Vision.
I was reading in the Seattle Times about how when the calf will slip off her, she'll dive down and get it again.
Yeah, we've seen this kind of behavior in certain species of cetaceans, and it's really, you know, without anthropomorphizing too much, it's really hard to avoid concluding that this is mourning. This is mourning behavior, and we've seen it in other species of dolphins, and it's heartbreaking to watch, especially when you realize how precious each of these calves are.
Yeah, it sure looks like grief. Is that not anthropomorphizing an animal too much?
I mean, anytime we project, you know, human emotions on, there's a danger of that. But I think it's pretty safe to say, you know, the scientists that have observed this say that this is a mourning behavior.
I saw a scientist from the Center for Whale Research, Ken Balcom, said maybe this is her protest. I don't know if he meant that literally.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe a bit of anthropomorphizing.
Metaphorically, though, perhaps.
But, you know, Ken has been a really outspoken and effective advocate for the real, you know, dangers that these southern residents face. You know, they're you know, on the brink of extinction, we think. And he's been a pretty loud and outspoken voice for the need for them to have enough food. I mean, that's really the fundamental issue here. I mean, there are other questions, you know, pollution, acoustic pollution, boat strikes, you know, all kinds of problems. But the main issue for them right now is that their primary food, Chinook salmon, king salmon, its numbers have been falling steadily the last few years and really in the last century. They're very specialized predators, and they almost exclusively feed on those, we think, and they're starving. This population is starving, and you see the real impact with their lack of reproductive success.
What's wrong with the Chinook salmon?
Well, I mean, the Chinook salmon numbers, for a number of reasons, you know, are remaking of the great rivers of the Northwest, you know, the Columbia in particular, but those in Puget Sound, the overfishing, just the industrialization of the area. We've seen this, you know, this used to be an area famous for not just gigantic Chinook, but gigantic Chinook runs. And if you think about this population, the southern residents, like the northern residents in northern BC, they developed a strategy over time of relying on these the largest salmon as food, which made sense as a large predator to, you know, most efficiently get calories was to catch these largest salmon. Made sense for the effort, but now they're stuck in a potentially a dead end here because they don't seem to be able to adjust to the dropping abundance of their main prey item.
You write about how we've changed how much we care about this situation. We've changed our view of the orcas. I grew up calling them killer whales.
Absolutely. I mean, this was a change that was stunningly rapid, and it went in tandem with the transformation of the Northwest from a sort of a working class extractive region where people fished and, you know, it was mostly fishing and logging to an area where we increasingly went out on the water for fun and recreation and saw wildlife not as a threat to us or to our resources, but something to be enjoyed. And this is probably the most striking example of this. You know, people growing up in the 1950s, 60s, even through the mid-60s, heard about them as blackfish, as killer whales, potentially menacing creatures. And now they are icons of our environment. And yet the great irony is we've stopped shooting them. We've stopped, you know, harming them outwardly, and yet the development of the region, the industrialization, is what seems to pose an existential threat to them now.
In fact, Jason, your family's part of that story.
Absolutely. I grew up in the region, grew up on both sides of the Salish Sea, actually both sides of the border, and my father in the 1970s participated in live captures of orcas on both sides of the border in 72, 73
Why?
Through 76. Well, at the time they were being procured for aquariums, marine parks. And, you know, in hindsight, this is a really, now that we know how few southern residents there are and the damage those live captures did, it's a really, you know, tragic to look back on. At the same time, and this, my book sort of writes about the complexity of this history, those live captures and the display, and especially the live study of them by scientists in captivity, was really transformative in the way people understood them, not just seeing them first as individuals, you know, really for the first time, but as sentient creatures with relationships. And so captivity and live study in captivity is really what brought about modern killer whale research, which has now, you know, transformed the way we think about wild killer whales. The fact that we, you know them as individuals and think about these precious individual relationships actually started with that industry. That doesn't, by the way, make it any easier for someone like my father to live with the guilt of taking these animals out of the wild.
Is he living with that guilt?
Yeah. I mean, it's complicated because, you know, people live their lives forward. They didn't know at the time that these were, you know, small, only, you know, small resident pods with incredibly limited reproductive capacities. They didn't know at the time that they had been, you know, probably in free fall because of other human violence, shootings and such. But, you know, when in the 1970s and early 80s, the research really ramped up on them, it became apparent how few there were. But it's also worth people remembering that you know, this population, the three pods of southern residents, J, K, and L, they did suffer tremendously from live capture, but their numbers rebounded to nearly 100 from their lows, probably in the high 60s or low 70s, rebounded to nearly 100 by the late 90s. In the last 20 years, they've crashed. And that has nothing to do with live capture. I mean, certainly that affected their demographics, but really what seemed to have hit them in this free fall in the last 20 years is loss of food, loss of prey availability.
Just before I leave your father's story, can you tell me how would he capture orcas?
Oh, well, he worked for Sealand of the Pacific in Victoria in the early 70s. He was the curator there, and there was several captures that they conducted in Petter Bay, which they used to procure whales both for Sealand and for sale elsewhere. And then he worked on this side of the border for the last capture that happened in Puget Sound, right off of Olympia in Budd Inlet. The Seattle Marine Aquarium, which was then owned by SeaWorld, captured a group of transient orcas, we now know, within sight of the state capitol, just after the state legislators were debating making Puget Sound a sanctuary for killer whales. And by the way, Ralph Monroe, who was an aide to Governor Dan Evans at the time, was actually out on a sailboat with friends, was horrified by the sight of this capture and became a lifelong advocate for orcas. And so it was a really transformational moment for many people involved.
By the way, we're live tweeting this show. I've interviewed Ralph Monroe about just that, and maybe we can link to that. Join us at KUOW. He was. There were explosives going off, and you know, people throwing the nets. So you said that live study in captivity has been important, has been a good thing for the orca population. What about shows? You know, SeaWorld jumping.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly debates about this, and most people, I think, most sensitive people that appreciate wild orcas now will admit that, you know, the choreographed shows in SeaWorld are, you know, in their eyes at least, you know, don't really represent orca behavior accurately. At the same time, when they were first displayed on the Seattle waterfront and in Vancouver and in San Diego in the 1960s, they gave a really different optic to this animal than people had before. I mean, previously, the impression people had of killer whales is that they were not just, you know, omnivorous and voracious and you know, toward other marine life, but could potentially eat people. I mean, the U.S. Navy diving manual warned to always get out of the water if killer whales ever approached, and because they would attack people, you know, if they were in the water. So the sight of an orca swimming with a person and not consuming that person, you know, and this first happened on the Seattle waterfront at Pier 56, when Ted Griffin, the owner of that aquarium, swam with Namu, the world famous killer whale in 1965. This was a transformative moment for people in the way they viewed this apex predator. It was written up in National Geographic, got coverage all over the world, and probably most importantly, you know, gave the first access of scientists to confirm, you know, that orcas use echolocation. First chance to really, you know, record their calls to figure out how their diving physiology worked, but also just to get to know them as individuals. And that's really, you know, that was a new form of science. You know, the only kind of science study of killer whales prior to that time that was being conducted, and it was being conducted right here in Seattle, what's now the National Marine Mammal Laboratory. The only kind of study they did was to go out and shoot and dissect orcas and examine their stomach contents. So this is the first time that anyone was studying them, as well as, you know, you got kids and future scientists seeing these shows and seeing these orcas as potentially friendly to people.
By the way, this is Dr. Jason Colby. The book is Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. How did we turn against orca captivity? Because there's only one freeborn orca still in captivity, I think.
There's one southern resident still in captivity. That's Lolita, who was
Lolita in Miami.
Captured. Yep, in 1970, and right off of Whidbey Island.
Yep.
She's still in captivity. There's another a northern resident named Corky too, who's in captivity in San Diego. I'd say there's a fascinating dynamic that occurs here, right? In the sense that as they're brought into human space and into human culture, and people get to interact with them and view them and watch them, get to know them on an individual basis, that their understanding of them is transformed. You start thinking about them as individuals. Start thinking about them as individuals with relationships that were being severed by the captures. And in fact, the sight of the captures and the sounds of the captures, and Puget Sound in particular, was really transformative in this. You know, people saw these captures, especially a big one in Penn Cove where Lolita was caught in 1970, was a transformative moment for how people thought about these animals, because, you know, even though the affection was rising for the public, they hadn't sort of seen the sights and the sounds of these captures, you know, heard orcas calling to one another, seen the separations that the nets created, you know, heard the calls as they were being, you know, raised up onto trucks. And this had a really powerful impact on people. You know, many of whom I interviewed described the sounds of the captures as just being etched into their minds, that they could hear like it was yesterday, you know, even though it's been almost 50 years. And so I'd say that, you know, all those things, you know, getting to know them in captivity actually made people want to appreciate them more in the wild. Really, the argument you didn't need to take them into captivity if you're in the Northwest, because they're right there, you know, passing through. And certainly the sights of these captures. And then ultimately, the realization of how few there were was really the pivot point, I think, when Northwesterners in particular turned against captivity.
Do you think, I don't know how well known the grief of an orca is, do you think that this week's photos and video of an orca carrying her dead calf on her back, Is this one of those moments?
Well, I'll tell you this: pictures can tell stories, and we saw, you know, for example, in the Vietnam War, how a couple of really iconic photos turned people's minds or raised people's attention. And I think that these photos of this mother carrying her dead calf tell a story. And who knows if she's trying to tell that story, but it tells a story for us. And the story is that we've failed them, right? This is a population that transformed not just the way the Pacific Northwest views orcas, but helped transform through science, through the founding of Greenpeace and its anti-whaling missions, helped transform the world views whales. I mean, this is more than any other cetacean population on Earth. This was the population that changed us, that transformed us. It made us better people, I would argue.
Why better people?
Well, I think because we started to think differently through them, how we treated the marine environment, and what we were putting into it, what we've been taking out, and ultimately they become icons for an environment, the Salish Sea, that's in crisis. And we're better people in the sense that we don't view the Salish Sea, I don't think, as an inexhaustible resource we can just dump raw waste into and take an unlimited amount out of. Now, a lot of the damage is already done, but the question is, can this story help generate the attention to help save this population? This population has gone through a lot and has paid a pretty heavy price for our slow change in our industrialization, our development. And so the question I would love my fellow Northwesterners on both sides of the border to ask themselves is, what do we owe them? Do we have a moral debt to them for what they've given to us to help make us better people?
If we decided we owe that moral debt, we would do what next?
There's lots of things we can do, but, and this is a hard thing to hear, but stopping commercial fishing and sports fishing of Chinook salmon until there's a recovery.
Should we not eat local wild salmon?
I wouldn't say to not eat local wild salmon, but wild-caught Chinook from the Northwest, which, you know, frankly, a lot of the Chinook, the kings that we eat here are from Alaska, which is a different question. You know, there are all kinds of questions about, you know, indigenous fishing rights that are really fraught on both sides of the border, especially in Washington, and I don't mean to question those rights.
You're not questioning indigenous fishing rights?
No, I'm not. And frankly, it wasn't indigenous fisheries that did the damage, ultimately, to the Chinook salmon runs. But we do have to ask ourselves if we should allow, you know, sports fishing in Puget Sound, which still goes on, even though Chinook salmon runs here, many of them are listed as endangered. That's one thing. Allowing some of the rivers to be undammed and healed and allow them to heal, you know, such as the Upper Snake, is another step. And then I think ultimately, as much as we can, reducing marine noise and pollution going into Puget Sound in particular. Yeah.
The Trump administration is talking about rolling back parts of the Endangered Species Act. I mean, that could affect the Snake River Dam debate, for example. How do you expect the Trump administration policy proposals would affect orcas?
Well, it won't help. I mean, I don't, you know, weakening the Endangered Species Act, which is also more attenuated than many people realize, when, in the sense that there's always, you know, questions of you know, balancing commercial development versus protection of endangered populations. Anytime you move to weaken hard-won environmental victories, can be a real threat. And certainly, we're talking about a population that's sitting on the edge of a knife here. I mean, it's not a question of they might be endangered. They may already be on the road to extinction, this population. And so anything that moves in the opposite direction of you know, providing less protection is obviously going to put even more pressure and more strain on them.
One more question, Jason. You said a moral obligation. Why not just enlightened self-interest obligation?
Well,
is there a difference?
There's certainly enlightened self-interest, and I think in the sense that I think a lot of people fail to realize what a large part of the economy now the southern resident orcas are. I mean, they're a draw on both sides of the border for, you know, dozens of ports now offer whale watching. About 500,000 people come, and just the people that pay for whale watching cruises in a number of about 500,000, not to mention all the people that go out on their own boats to see them in kayaks and such. So it's we're talking about you know, millions and millions and millions brought in the tourist industry for them. I would also say there's an enlightened self-interest in the sense that the southern resident killer whales are the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, meaning they're at the very top of the food chain in the Salish Sea. And if they're starving, and if their bodies are so toxic they have to be treated as hazardous waste when they die, something's really wrong with our ecosystem. And people need to realize that. A lot of people are newcomers to the Salish Sea that have moved here, you know, from other parts of the world and the country. And I think they tend to see this area as pristine and beautiful. You know, you move here for the nature, but actually they're seeing an ecosystem that's a shadow of its former self, and a badly poisoned and depleted one. And this animal, this iconic apex predator, is telling us that with their bodies, with their pain, right? The pain that this mother is showing.
Dr. Jason Colby, Associate Professor of Environmental History at the University of Victoria and the author of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. We're talking, among other things, about the passing of yet another orca calf this week. And if you want to hear more about Jason's book, he was in town last month. You were here at Town Hall, and your talk is online, and we recorded it at KUOW Speakers Forum, so we'll link to that conversation as well. Dr. Jason Colby, thanks for coming in to KUOW.
Thank you so much for having me.